Okay. Are we back up? Oh, boy. Check. All right. Camera's working properly. Microphone's working properly. Over here in the shooter scene. Check, 1, 2. Check, 1, 2. It's super hot. Why is it so super hot? Hey, bud. So, yeah, apparently we're just going to go. We're only going to be in this scene because the microphone seems to be working fine, and this scene because the microphone seems to be working fine, and then I'll just figure out the stuff for the gaming side when we get to the gaming portion. So, all right. Hello, nerds. Sorry for all of the issues, but apparently it was needed. Welcome to another live episode of The Week in Nerddom. The pop culture nerd news as it matters. We have, it would seem that there is quite a bit of things in the rumor mill that we're going to be talking about. If you follow the socials, then you already know at least one of the things, because watched an Overlord DVD video when I got home from the day job today. And he was talking about the things that I heard at work yesterday, which is what the picture was all about. So, yeah, it's we have some stuff to get through without any. I don't think there's any. Oh, there is housekeeping before we get into it. We're going to structure the end of the news portion for this episode a little bit differently. I actually planned ahead, thankfully, for the music stuff. And then I think we're going to be off for another 2 weeks. Next week, I think I have a scheduling issue. And then the following week, I will be making up for lost time at work. So we're going to be another 2 weeks off. But that's why it was so important to get today going, because it was needed. Something is having issues. So let's see if we can find it. Everything still seems to be acceptable, so at least the VOD will be okay. What is audio? Hey, Mr. Christopher Ortiz, can you hear me speaking? There is going to be a delay because chat, but YouTube says it can't hear my audio. But everything is showing that the audio should be fine. So, yeah. All right. Let's jump right into the news, I guess. Viewers will be experiencing buffing. Okay. Cool. Fine. Let's just do the news then. Apparently, I am being heard perfectly. We're not going to start here, even though that's where we want to. This is going to be somewhere down lower. So let's just start at the top. DC Comics website rebrands as DC. This is it. So it seems that a lot of this stuff is going to be very DC and Warner Brothers centric. If what Mr. Overlord DVD was talking about is going to be all over this, which I believe, I'm pretty sure Cosmic Book and Overlord both have similar, if not the same, sources, so we're probably going to be a lot, really heavy in the DC. Warner Brothers Discovery has dropped the comics from DC as a new website is launched from the previous dccomics.com, which redirects to dc.com. Interesting. Website sees a redesign that focuses more on the movies, as Dwayne Johnson as Black Adam is front and center. Ooh. Been told Johnson wants to take over the DC films. Ooh. Press release. DC.com is the new digital home to explore the DC multiverse. So they're leaning into the multiverse idea. The official statement is as follows. DC Today unveils its fan-focused portal at DC.com, which will give fans easy access to all things DC, from fan-first news to DC Universe Infinite. DC Shop. Oh, DC Universe Infinite is the what they rebranded the platform for their comic books, the digital version of their comic books. It's just been a while since I've seen it written in front of me. DC Shop, DC Community, and DC on HBO Max, which there were rumblings when I was doing research for the regular episode last week that even the HBO Max situation is not safe right now. So hopefully we'll see more of that and we can get into it a little bit. But new DC.com homepage will feature weekly drops of new video content, editorial, deep dives, fan discussions, digital experiences, and more. Fans will now access everything from DC Universe Infinite to DC Community with a single unified user profile. So that makes sense. Quote, DC.com is a celebration of everything across the DC multiverse, and we couldn't be more excited for today's launch, said DC General Manager and SVP Ann DePies. Doubling down on DC's digital ecosystem, and there has never been a better time to be a DC fan. Everyone's saying that this is everyone. The little bit that I've heard saying that DC is in turmoil, what with the Discovery, Warner Brothers Discovery merger, and then the Zaslav guy that's now the CEO of the new company is getting rid of stuff left and right. And if the Batgirl rumor turns out to be true, which I don't see why it wouldn't be at this point, then there's a lot of other stuff that is looking to be potentially on the chopping block. So yeah, that's the basic gist of that piece is DC is rebranding, which is not exactly a bad thing. It's because it's only on the digital side. So if they drop the comics portion altogether, I think that's going to be cause for concern. So next, Green Lantern, HBO Max series not canceled. All right. So this is a refutation of rumor that we talked about in the last regular episode. Lots of rumors follow the cancellation of Batgirl, but this one turns out not to be true for now. Well, that was quick reading the article. As following me first reporting on the rumor that the Green Lantern HBO Max series has been canceled, it's now said that that isn't the case. A Twitter user who writes for Screen Rant tweeted he contacted Warner Discovery, who confirmed Green Lantern is not canceled. As following cancellation of Batgirl, it was said Green Lantern also got the axe. Also, the rumor said that it had been axed in secret for months, and that is not the case, apparently. Much like I called the months thing out in the episode. So rumor started when Twitter user Great Phase claimed the Green Lantern HBO Max series had actually been canned a while ago, but again, according to new info, that didn't happen. And then that goes into what the Green Lantern series is going to be. We already know all that. And casting and stuff. So, like I said, the official word from Warner Brothers about Green Lantern has not changed. So that's why we didn't go super high with the likelihood on Green Lantern for the last regular episode. Warner Brothers and David Zaslav moving away from Zack Snyder's Justice League. This one has been rumbling since before I went on vacation. So let's get into this, shall we? It appears as if Warner Brothers Discovery and CEO David Zaslav are distancing themselves and moving away from Zack Snyder's Justice League movie. So there, I heard rumblings. Den of Nerds, I believe, was talking about this, and I'm pretty sure that's where I heard it, where there is reason to believe that the Release the Snyder Cut movement that happened on social media might not have been legitimate, because it was huge. Like, there's no denying the digital size of it. There were a lot of people that were tweeting out hashtag Snyder Cut, Release the Snyder Cut, yada, yada, yada. But now there is reason to believe that a fair portion of that, I don't know, I'm not going to go so far as to say maybe half or more, but a fair portion at least was bot accounts that were doing nefarious things on the digital side of things in order to artificially inflate the demand for Zack Snyder's Justice League, because when it released on HBO Max, it didn't do that great. It did moderately well, but it didn't do as good as it should have if the digital uproar would have been to be believed. But we are birdwalking. Let's get back to this article, shall we? Where the mention is that the cancellation of the Batgirl movie means the J.K. Simmons Commissioner Gordon will no longer be appearing in the film. Yes, who was Zack Snyder's choice to play the character in his Justice League? I love Simmons. Since Simmons played Gordon, the father to Batgirl, that means that Batgirl was attached to the Snyderverse. That makes sense. However, the bigger news comes with revealed that Warner Brothers Discovery turned down a request to use footage from Zack Snyder's Justice League in a DC documentary for HBO Max, where Rolling Stone says the reason they wouldn't let footage be used in the documentary is that Warner Discovery considers the Joss Whedon 2017 release the only incarnation. That's probably not a good direction to take that. Oof. That means Warner Brothers Discovery doesn't consider Zack Snyder's Justice League movie as a real thing, a part of the DCEU, and Rolling Stone further reports the studio has no plans to work with Snyder again. That one's kind of been a long time coming. We knew that was going to happen. All right, so now we're getting to the meaty bits. Speaking of DC, Ben Affleck is back for Ben Affleck is back for Batman in Aquaman 2. That is true. Jason Momoa gave us that during San Diego Comic-Con. We actually touched on that, Chris. We touched on that in the last regular episode. It was real quick, so you might have missed it if you watched the episode. But yes, Affleck is back in the cape and cowl, at least for Aquaman 2. It sounds like, if some of these rumors are to be believed, it sounds like the only person who is currently making DCEU movies that is going to continue once the dust has settled from this merger is Dwayne Johnson. The Rock is going to be the only one in a super suit. Potentially, I could see the Shazam family sticking around too, just because they're not directly tied to anything really, which kind of is to their benefit. But yeah, it seems that The Rock is going to be kind of the new big bad for the DCEU once we get a proper reboot, which, it, again, according to Overlord, Doomcock, there we go. According to Doomcock, he's saying that his sources say that Zaslav is trying to get a reboot done kind of ASAP, because he views the next big threat from Marvel, from Disney, as when they can finally use the X-Men, or when they finally end up using the X-Men, which he predicts is going to be somewhere around the 10-year mark. But where does that timer start is the real question, because 10-year mark after they purchased the X-Men, then we're already 2 years into that. So it's only 8 years, so the time's really counting down. But it seems that the sources for Doomcock are saying 10 years from roughly now. So I don't know if I buy that part of it, though a lot of what he was saying in his video today, I think there is a lot of truth in there. So back to the 10-year Marvel plan. This actually ties into what Doomcock was saying. Because Zaslav, that's what a lot of the sources for Cosmic Book and Den of Nerds and Doomcock all are saying, that Zaslav wants to do a big unified universe, if you will, Warner Brothers Discovery CEO David Zaslav reveals DC plans include a 10-year Marvel-style plan. Zaslav addressed the DC film's universe during an investor Q&A on the company's quarter two call, which follows the recent cancellation of the Batgirl movie that was supposed to be released on HBO Max streaming service. Quote, our ambition is to bring Warner's back... Our ambition is to bring Warner's back and produce great, high-quality films, he said. We can build a long-term, sustainable growth business out of DC. We're not going to release any film before it's ready. We're not going to release a film to make a quarter. The focus is going to be on how do we make each of these films in general as good as possible. But DC is something that we think we could make better, and we're focused on it now, which is how movie making should be. You shouldn't be trying to The money shouldn't be first and foremost. The quality storytelling should be first and foremost, and then the money will come. And I think that's what previous powers that be over at Warner Brothers and DC have really been missing, and what I think Marvel and Disney are starting to lose sight of as well, because, I mean, we watched the most recent Marvel movies, and they've been on a pretty steady decline for some time now. The article continues. Flash movie's still happening. Zaslav also mentioned the Justice League characters. This was another rumor that we didn't put in the last proper episode because this is just wishful thinking on a lot of people's parts, I think. Zaslav also mentioned the Justice League characters. Look, you look at Batman, Superman, Wonder Woman, and Aquaman. These are brands that are known everywhere in the world, Zaslav said. And the ability to drive those all over the world with great story is a big opportunity for us. We have done a reset. We've restructured the business where we're going to focus where there is going to be a team with a 10-year plan focusing just on DC. That is great news. We believe we can build a much more sustainable business. Yes, please, and thank you. It's very popular to the structure that Alan Horn and Bob Iger put together very effectively with Kevin Feige at Disney, he said. We think we could build a long-term, much stronger, sustainable growth business out of DC, and as part of that, we're going to focus on quality. Regarding the upcoming slate of DC releases, Zaslav confirmed, The Flash is still happening. We've seen The Flash, Black Adam, and Shazam 2, he said. We are very excited about them. We've seen them. We think they are terrific, and we think we can make them even better. Ooh, that's an interesting way to end that phrase. We think we can make them even better. Being as Shazam 2 is almost here, Black Adam is like next month, and The Flash is also almost here. That almost leaves the door open for the potential of some pretty big reshoots. And also with him saying that a movie's not going to be released before it's done, that also lends one to believe that maybe he's leaving the door open for reshoots. Zaslav added, the objective is to grow the DC brand, to grow the DC characters, but also our job is to protect the DC brand. And that's what we're going to do. That is a smart man speaking, apparently. We'll always be agile, he said, but the focus will always be on theatrical. Update to the article. The following images were shown at the Warner Brothers Discovery Investors Call, where DC is listed as a studio, and Batman, Wonder Woman, and Superman are listed as part of the global powerhouse franchises. Interesting. So let's take a look at this. Can I make this bigger? Open image in a new tab. Because I'm in a different browser. That's why. Let's get this bigger, shall we? All right. So, quarter two of 22 revenues, corporate revenues are liminal. Studio revenues make up the bulk of that. Digital streaming and networks make up similar. It looks like streaming is lower than networks, but not by much. So they have Warner Brothers Television, DC, New Line Cinema, and Warner Brothers Animation Group, all as studios. Which, okay, I follow. Networks are HGTV, TLC, Food Channel, CNN, oof. That one they might want to reconsider. TNT, TBS, OWN, Discovery, Magnolia Network, Eurosport, and TVN. I think TVN is the Hispanic station network that they have. Eurosports is obvious. Magnolia, I'm not sure what that is. Discovery, obviously. OWN is Oprah's. And then the rest of those are fairly obvious. And then the streaming, they have Discovery Plus, HBO Max, and HBO. What would DTC be explicitly, I guess, would be the question. But that makes sense otherwise. So then Global Powerhouse. So this is presumably IPs that they own that they want to, have some sort of focus on. So brands, HBO, Discovery, CNN. I don't know that. I feel like that CNN thing is going to change. HGTV, I'm sure, makes them a whole boatload of cash. Cartoon Network, which apparently falls under the Warner Brothers Animation Group. DC and Looney Tunes, which also would fall under the Animation Group. That makes sense. Franchises. What's the difference between a brand and a franchise, though? Like, why would you separate those two? Batman, Wonder Woman, Superman, Shark Week, Game of Thrones, 90 Day Fiancé universe. What the hell is that? And then Harry Potter, the wonderful wizarding world of Harry Potter. Iconic series and characters. This is pretty obvious. Friends, Fixer Upper, Big Bang Theory, Property Brothers, Triple D. Interesting. So they're gonna throw more money at Guy Fieri. I mean, if for nothing else for Triple D, then I'm pretty excited about it. But I don't know. That's a weird thing in the rest of this. But and then Sex and the City apparently is still big on their radar. So I don't necessarily see that franchise going anywhere anytime soon. Going away anytime soon, anyway. And then international stuff, TVN, Eurosport, Discovery Kids. How is that international? That doesn't make sense. D-Max, Nova, and TV Norge. I don't know what most of those are, but international. Okay, interesting. Very, very interesting. Theatrical over streaming. Zaslav also addressed theatrical versus streaming releases. There's no comparison when you launch a film in motion picture theaters. He said expensive films going to streaming can't find an economic value for it. Zaslav also added there will be a number of movies, quote unquote, being launched with shorter windows. So if it's not a blockbuster, it'll probably have like a 30 to 45 day window, whereas like something like Black Adam, Batman, so on and so forth will probably have something more akin to like a 90 day window before it hits streaming. That makes sense. All right, here we go. This is the one.
Who's that? Brendan Small?
That's on. All right, so.
Really?
Okay, so this just in, we're going to go to the Instagram real quick. Let's go to Middle Lock. I'll go to Brendan Small, yeah. Because Metalocalypse is not coming to me. Brendan Small, there he is. That is not the Brendan Small. That's unfortunate. D-O-N? Oh, I'm dumb. There he is. Ah, here we go. So, Brennan Small was just robbed. Breaking music news. Brennan Small, for those, and actually animation news. Brennan Small, for those that don't know, is the creator of the Home Movies series that was on Adult Swim forever, and also Metalocalypse. So studio was robbed, guitar stolen. Keep an eye out for a Les Paul Gold Top 57 reissue. Ibanez JS24 Orange, Ibanez Gem Universe Moog guitar. Oh, he has a Moog guitar. I'm so jealous. Well, had, I guess. That sucks. Gibson Thunderhorse prototype. No, that's his signature. Gibson SG Tobacco Burst 12 string and Gibson Standard Black. Plus Gibson Les Paul 59 Tobacco Burst reissue. Gibson Buckethead Studio Les Paul. Oh man, that is some beautiful guitars. Those are, I can speak. Kramer 1984 unfinished Warmoth Strat with a maple top and a Fender 54 Custom Shop Strat reissue. Wow. That sucks. That is a lot of fantastic gear that is not there anymore. Huh. Well, so if you live in the Los Angeles area, I believe that's where his studio is, where he makes the musics and the things. Excuse me. Brennan Small was just robbed within the last day or two. All right, so here we go. This is the elusive Supergirl rumor. So this is, it is very much rumor. So take with this what you will, but Supergirl's Sasha Calle movie likely canceled. Looks to be good news if you're a Superman fan, as it's reported that the Supergirl Sasha Calle movie is likely canceled and won't be moving forward. Well, they haven't filmed anything for it yet, so that makes sense. The news comes from Rolling Stone. Oh, this comes deep then. I mean, Rolling Stone, I don't know that they necessarily have the greatest track record with breaking stuff like this, but they are pretty well established. So if they're talking about it, I wonder who broke it. Following Supergirl movie is mentioned. Now, the prospect of other DC films being squashed looms. Insiders say Supergirl, which is in development, is not likely to move forward. Sasha Calle, who plays the caped heroine, is introduced in the upcoming Flash. Supergirl was going to spin off of the Miller-led tentpole. Why the cancellation of Supergirl movie means good things for Superman is because we've discussed this on live shows and I think in regular shows as well. The plan was, at least the rumor was, that the plan was for Supergirl to replace Superman in the movie universe, because they wanted to turn their focus in a more diverse direction, I think was the official vocabulary. Whereas that's not really how Zaslav wants to play ball. The Flash seems to indicate that the plan as scenes in The Flash involving Supergirl are said to have basically reshot scenes involving Michael Shannon as Zod in Zack Snyder's Man of Steel starring Henry Cavill. So rumor based on rumor based on rumor. This is kind of a whole lot going on. And then this is another thing that Doomcock talked about in his video, is that there is potentially going to be, again, according to rumor, going to be a Henry Cavill post-credit stinger in the Black Adam movie, because Dwayne Johnson is a big proponent of Henry Cavill. He wants Henry Cavill to stay as Superman. So if that happens, and all of the rumors are to be believed, pardon me, if that happens and all of the rumors are to be believed, then that would mean that Henry Cavill would remain Superman with the reboot going on as well, which is interesting. Update: Warner Brothers 10-year plan falling was shown as global. But yeah, we've already looked at that. Okay, interesting. And then this one, my girlfriend told me about yesterday, so we'll talk about it. Lady Gaga confirmed, so confirmation of rumor. Lady Gaga confirmed Joker 2 in announcement video. Lady Gaga confirms involvement in Joker 2 as the actress singer posted the following announcement video on social media. Can we pull it open? I think we can. Interesting. Phoenix, Gaga, Joker. Huh. Folie à deux. 10/4/24. So there's a release date now for it and everything. Todd Phillips will also be back where he is directing, co-writing the sequel per the title, Folie à deux, to a French term for medical condition meaning madness for two. So it's guessed the sequel deals with a female version of Joker who is just as crazy and dark as the Joaquin Phoenix version. Was he really? I mean, I guess he was pretty dark by the end of that movie. All right, I'll allow it. Folie à deux is a psychiatric syndrome described as shared psychosis or shared delusional disorder. So do we think... All right, let's speculate for a minute here, nerds. Do we think that... Lady Gaga, her version of Harley Quinn is going to, or is it going to be Harley Quinn? A, because none of this is explicitly said that. So there, that is potentially something that they, that might not happen. Is it going to be Harley Quinn that she's playing, or is it going to be like a Duella Dent or an alternate? They're going to take something from one of the alternate universe versions of female Joker, because it's not going to be Joker's daughter. That would be weird. But is it going to be Harley Quinn? And if it's not, then is it going to be female Joker? I think there is a fair argument to be made that it will be some variation of Harley Quinn, being as at the end of the first movie, he was in a psychiatric hospital. That is where he meets Harley Quinn, is at the at Arkham. She's trying to help him, and then he twists and distorts who she is. So that makes a little bit more sense to me. But I'm kind of more excited because of how off the rails the first movie was. I'm kind of excited about the possibility that it's a female Joker. You have two different Jokers that then could influence some sort of mainline like Joker that we know and love from the comic books. I think that is a much more exciting possibility. And then that also doesn't tie down Lady Gaga to being second fiddle, which is what Harley Quinn usually excels at. Even in her animated show, which I enjoy, I think her the animated show on HBO Max is hilarious and a great substitute for the Venture Brothers. But I don't know. I feel like. Gaga is a little bit more of a personality that would lend itself to want to be more front and center than usually they do for Harley Quinn. So very interesting. So this might be like 100% confirmation of this canceling, or maybe it's just there has already been 100% confirmation and I've just missed it because, you know, day job and such. Leslie Grace has responded to the cancellation of Batgirl movies. See, everybody's talking like it's 100% confirmed, but as far as I know, there's not been an official statement from Warner Brothers or HBO. Even all of those Zaslav's quotes that we just read through didn't say that this had been canceled. So... the actress who would have played the first Latino Batgirl in Barbara Gordon took to her Instagram and Instagram story to share the following, where she first posted a video featuring Taylor Swift's song Shake It Off. Querida family, on the heels of the recent news about our movie background, I'm proud of the love, hard work, and intention of all of our incredible cast and tireless crew to put in. So yeah, this is, we now know 100% that it's been canceled. This film over 7 months in Scotland. I feel blessed to have worked among absolute greats and forged relationships for a lifetime in the process. To every Batgirl fan, thank you for the love and belief, allowing me to take on the cape and become, as Babs said best, my own damn hero. Grace finished with the post, echoing Batgirl directors Adil El Arbi and Bilal Falah's response to the news. Hashtag Batgirl for life. Batgirl filmmakers released a joint statement, yeah, where they said they are saddened and shocked by the news. So this is news. This is not rumor anymore. Decision to not release Batgirl reflects our leadership's strategic shift as it relates to the DC Universe and HBO Max, says the statement in part. Lissy Grace is an incredibly talented actor, and this decision is not a reflection of her performance. We are incredibly grateful to the filmmakers Batgirl and Scoob Holiday Haunt. So apparently that has been canceled as well. That sucks. I really kind of liked that animated Scoob movie, not gonna lie. We hope to collaborate with everyone again in their future. So there you go, confirmation of what was very likely rumor. That the Batgirl movie is in fact not going to be happening. Don't stop believing. Ryan Reynolds now training for Deadpool 3. Ooh, how do we know this? As his trainer Don Saladino posted the following photos on Instagram. Let's get to it. View this post on IG. Of course, why not? Rob Liefeld, both so buff. And so it begins. Oh, okay. Suit up with Don. Nothing of this is saying Deadpool. No, it doesn't say Deadpool at all. He's training for something, sure. Likely it's Deadpool, but no, there's no explicit quote. Yeah. Both so buff, commented Liefeld. According to IMDb, Ryan Reynolds has been training with Don Saladino since X-Men Origins Wolverine and Green Lantern movie. The pair have trained together for RIPD, Selfless, Deadpool. See, so they've trained for multiple movies. The fact that he's training with Saladino right now does not say that he's gearing up for Deadpool 3. It says he's gearing up for a movie, but since we have no idea when Deadpool 3 is actually going to happen, we do know it is going to happen and that it's in pre-production. So it's possible. I would even go so far as to say probable that it's going to happen. This is technically a rumor. We are talking about rumor here. Ryan Reynolds is gearing up for a movie. Not nearly as exciting as the headline wants you to think it is. Moon Knight season 2 teased by Oscar Isaac. Ooh. I don't care what the community says. I dug the Moon Knight series. I thought that was a lot of fun. I thought that they portrayed a version of what is in the comic books fairly well, and it was very compelling and exciting to watch. So I don't see as many of the issues with the Moon Knight series as... That's also probably because I've never really read any of the Moon Knight comics, not gonna lie. Moon Knight Season 2 might be a go by Marvel for Disney Plus, judging from the following video featuring Oscar Isaac and director Mohamed Diab. I believe this is actually... That it actually... Blah, blah, blah. Sorry, words. I believe that is actually Mohamed Diab's daughter and TikTok accountant who asked the question on everyone's mind. Is there a season two? Mohamed Diab seems caught off guard by the question. Oscar Isaac responds, what else would we be doing in Cairo? Makes sense. Obviously, they could all be having fun, but I'll say I did really like... See, even the cynical comic book news liked Moon Knight a lot. So a season two would be pretty cool. Yeah, the comic book is usually a place that calls a spade a spade. So if it doesn't match up with the comic book continuity or the comic book mythology perfectly, that's secondary to the fact that it told a good and compelling story. I also think the article goes on to say, I also think Feige blew a huge opportunity to include the Egyptian gods in Thor, Love and Thunder as part of the Zeus scene. Absolutely. But then come again, seeing how Love and Thunder is so goofy and silly, the Egyptian gods and Moon Knight really don't fit at that part of the goofy MCU. Valid point. Still haven't actually watched Thor Love and Thunder, but I'm pretty sure I understand that well enough. Moon Knight cosplay at DCC 22. That's pretty great, actually. All right. Moving on to the next article. We actually... okay. Yeah, we'll finish up here and then we'll go to the movie thing or the music thing rather that I wanted to do. Huh. We have actually, there's quite a bit that we're still going to touch on. Shazam 2 and Aquaman 2 release dates may move. Yes. All right. So this is getting into that Zaslav thing that had me worried. The vocabulary he was using definitely felt like this is a possibility for a lot of things. All right. Following the cancellation of Batgirl, the big DC changes may also include Shazam 2 and Aquaman 2 moving their release dates. In THR's report behind the cancellation of Batgirl, it's mentioned that Warner Bros. Discovery is considering moving the release date for both Shazam and Aquaman. See, there's that picture, Chris, of that Jason Momoa posted to his Instagram that confirms that Ben Affleck is, in fact, going to be returning as Batman. This comes from THR. Batgirl news comes ahead of Warner Bros. Discovery earnings call Thursday, which, again, this article was written before. With rumors swirling around that Warner's is considering moving the release dates for two of the upcoming films, Shazam! Fury of the Gods, currently slated for December 21st, and Aquaman and Lost Kingdom, currently set for March of 23. On Wednesday, studio revealed an October date for Joker sequel. That's a fair point, because... No, that would still make sense. October for Joker, December for Shazam. When is Flash, though? See, that's the big question. Because Flash, there's still plenty of rumors floating around that Flash is going to be what sets up this big change in the DCEU. So Ben Affleck is Batman, that's our confirmation, blah, blah, blah. This is the other thing I want to get to, because I am a big fan of Blue Beetle. I think Jaime is a great character, and I think his movie deserves to be in theaters. Also, love Michael Keaton as Batman. Not going to lie. I think it's great. Moon Knight was amazing. Must agree. Absolutely. Emojis shown in the comments represents Deadpool. All right, let's go back. I apologize. I didn't read that comment sooner, so let's go back to that. Oh, poops. Going back to the Instagram post for the Deadpool. Oh, I get it. Okay. You have a red dot and swords. That makes sense. I feel a little dense right now. I'm not going to lie. Thank you very much, Chris. Good call. The red is the mask and the X looking thing are the swords. Yep, that's absolutely, you are correct. I think you are correct. So there we go. That is still not explicit, but much more resembling explicit. Moon Knight was amazing. Must agree. Yeah, absolutely agree. So back to Blue Beetle. Following Batgirl cancellation, all of these articles are starting that way, aren't they? Batman Michael Keaton is now in doubt, as is the release of Blue Beetle moving, starring Zolo Maradueña. I always struggle with his last name. Warner Bros. Discovery and CEO David Zaslav canceled Batgirl according to reports, blah, 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 not being well received in test screenings. Michael Keaton in doubt with the cancellation of Batgirl movie. Good Lord, just get to the point, please. Michael Keaton Batman not getting released, which follows Jason Momoa's earlier reveal that Ben Affleck is returning in Batman as Batman in Aquaman 2. So that means two appearances by Keaton as Batman have now been shelved, with a lot of it having to do with the fact that the Ezra Miller Flash movie gets released last as part of the... Okay, so that's coming out after Aquaman. Weird. I still think that's a poor choice. As I and many fans theorize, it now seems as if the Michael Keaton Batman are in doubt, which THR also agrees with, as the site writes, the death of Batgirl also hints at a diminished role for Keaton going forward. Let's get here. There we go. Blue Beetle release questioned. Regarding Blue Beetle, following the Batgirl cancellation, fans took to social media to wonder about the fate of Blue Beetle, as it's another movie with a Latino lead that was originally low budget and set to be released on HBO Max. But they upped it, and they're going to release it theatrical. Since announced for a theatrical release, which may save it as the budget is probably now higher, which is probably worrisome about the Blue Beetle release, is that following Batgirl news, director Angel Manuel Soto liked tweets asking the studio to save Blue Beetle, which, as noted by THR, underscores the uncertainty Warner's talent faces at this time. James Gunn also confirmed Peacemaker is safe. Of course it is, because it, too, was great. What? Marvel's Eternals 2 already announced, says Patton Oswalt. What does Patton Oswalt have to do with anything? It wasn't officially been announced. While speaking with the Today Show, Patton Oswalt, who provided the voice of Pip the Troll in the post-credit scene. Oh, that would be why. I also didn't watch Eternals. I don't see a point in watching that movie, not going to lie. And appeared alongside Harry Styles as Star Fox, the brother of Thanos, says Eternals 2 is happening and that Chloe Zhao is directing. We've announced there's going to be an Eternal sequel and Chloe Zhao is going to direct it, Patton said. So hopefully there will be more adventures of Star Fox and Pip. I guess the problem is that Eternals hasn't been announced, so either Oswald mixed up his words or he let it slip that an announcement might be coming soon, which would possibly happen next month at D23. I think D23 is going to be huge. I think now I am totally in agreement that the Deadpool 3 is happening next. So that will very likely be announced there. It looks like very potentially Eternals 2 will be. Yeah, and then just goes into what a disappointment Eternals 1 was. Predator Prey, Rotten Tomatoes, higher than Arnold Schwarzenegger movie. This is the last one, and then we're going to move over to the movie stuff. Or the music stuff. Goodness. Predator Prey, Rotten Tomatoes score is in... as the premiere was held last night, the movie officially debuts Friday on Hulu, so today. With 61 reviews currently accounted for, Prey has a 97% score. Interesting, which is the highest of the franchise and even higher than 1987 Arnold Schwarzenegger movie that started it all, which comes in at only 80%. Second highest is 2010 Predators film, which with 65%, 2018's Predator is next at 33%. Predator 2, starring Danny Glover, came out in 90, has a 30%. Oh, come on now. That one was fun. Obviously not as good as the Schwarzenegger movie, but I feel like better than the Predator that came out in 2018. But again, haven't watched that one either because I haven't heard anything good about it. AVP, the number one, 21%, and AVP 2 comes in at 12%. Oh, this somebody that Cosmic Book knows attended a premiere in Hollywood and actually liked it. And a Twitter user said more of the same. So maybe there is hope that the flick will be decent. I actually really dig it. Action choreography was intense, said my friend. Definitely better than what I was expecting. He also confirmed Prey ties into something else. Oh, cool. There is a spoiler tie-in. Didn't feel like Wonder Woman 1984. That's good. Curious to see how critics will react to it. I think it's one of the better Predator films in a good while. That is very promising. That is a really cool image of the Predator. I dig it. Oh, look at that mask. That's cool. All right. So let me go get the URL for this music thing, and we will go over some music stuff, and then we'll take a brief break and come back and play some multiverses. I just got it downloaded. And then probably some Halo and call it a night. All right, so this I thought was just a little bit too much fun to not dive into. This is from Loudwire. They have the big four bands of the 17 metal subgenres, or of 17, not the 17. So the big four, pardon me, for those that do not know, the big four, well, I guess it gets into it. For the longest time were thrash bands, because for a long time thrash was kind of the front runner subgenre for metal, because Metallica, Slayer, Megadeth, and Anthrax, those are the big four. Those are potentially the biggest bands in metal there, and Metallica now is one of the biggest musical acts in the world, so like rightfully so they're called the big four. So what about the rest of the genre? After all, metal has become immeasurably varied and vital over the last 50 plus years. Yes, it has. So let's get into 17 metal subgenres. So new wave of American heavy metal. This would be bands like Lamb of God, Unearth, I think might fall in here, though they might just be metalcore. I am apparently getting a phone call that I'm probably not going to answer. Yeah, no, I'm not going to talk to my boss. New Wave of America, they're going to count Slipknot apparently as New Wave of American heavy metal, which I like better than nu metal, which is where they were put for a long, long time. So that works. When it comes to bringing brutal screams and instrumentation, anthemically catchy clean vocals, and unapologetically colorful antics and costumes to widespread attention, Slipknot are unmatched. Their rags-to-riches success, coupled with their well-known traumatic history, idiosyncratic look, make them wildly influential and significant. Not to mention that they brought blast beats to the masses. This is a top 40 charting band, and they have blast beats in every one of their records. So that is pretty awesome. Avenged Sevenfold, new wave of American heavy metal. I guess I can kind of see it. They're a little more metalcore as far as, I don't know. And we have what Loudwire says is, in a nutshell, Avenged Sevenfold helped guide metal to the mainstream without ever losing sight of their eclectic, if also comparatively accessible, integrity. Plus, their ability to persevere, after so many lineup changes and other hardships is a testament to their talent, impact, and dedication. No lineup changes. They've gone through a couple of different drummers, but otherwise the band is exactly the same as it was when they put out Sounding the Seventh Trumpet or Waking the Fallen. I can never remember which one of those came out first. And then Lamb of God, yes, they are kind of the definitive band for this subgenre. Picking up the torch from idols such as Pantera, Black Sabbath, and Slayer, Lamb of God were there at the start, plain and simple. Their earliest LPs are celebrated for intricately merging those styles around Randy Bly's standout singing. 2020 self-titled album proved that they still are masters of their craft. It was a great album. Not their best, but it was a great album. And then Trivium, Trivium, sure. That makes sense to put them in this subgenre. Frontman Matt Heafy is easily among the most distinctive, poetic, and respected performers around. I don't know about poetic, but respected, sure. Group's ventures into progressive metal, power metal, and melodic death consistently push the new wave American heavy metal forward. Case in point, 2021's In the Court of the Dragon, which ranks alongside both Trivium's best efforts and the best metal albums of the year. I've only heard two tracks off of In the Court of the Dragon, but those two tracks are super solid, and I would definitely understand that argument. Death metal. Death Sure, makes sense. 87 debut LP Scream Bloody Gore is often hailed as the first death metal album, and despite disbanding roughly 20 years ago due to the death of founding member singer-guitarist Chuck Schuldiner, their legacy endures to this day. Need we say more? Well, yeah, okay, whatever. Cannibal Corpse absolutely had to be on the death metal big four. No other act combines gory, debauched aesthetics and corrosive sounds better than Cannibal Corpse. They're also one of the genre's best-selling artists, as well as perhaps the most widely memed group in death metal. Yep, 100%. Morbid Angel also totally makes sense to be one of the big four. Basically, right there with death, helping pioneer and popularize death metal by showcasing how technical and forward-thinking it could be, due in no small part to the inventiveness of guitarist Trey Azagoth. Their earliest releases are considered seminal, and 2017's Kingdoms Disdained was generally regarded as a proper return to form. Never really got into Morbid Angel, but I'm aware of their sound and a lot of the stuff that they've put out, so yeah, totally makes sense. Black Dahlia. Would Black Dahlia be death? Ooh, I don't know if I agree with this one. This is the first one I kind of wholeheartedly disagree with. They deserve to be in the big four of a subgenre, but I would say more... I don't even know. Like, math metal, maybe? I mean, they are kind of deathy. Melodic death at points, but... There's so much more to Black Dahlia than just that death element that this doesn't seem to fit. Drawing from ensembles such as Carcass and At the Gates, the Black Dahlia Murder are relative newcomers to the scene since they began in 2001. However, their enticingly synonymous take on melodic death metal has resulted in an almost steady ascension in terms of chart placement and word of mouth reverie, so their supremacy is already firmly established. Moving on, now we're into prog. Alright, so let's see if I can call out the prog. We're gonna see Between the Buried and Me and prog metal, though. Between the Buried and Me, and that's the only one I think I can foresee coming. Opeth will be the other one. Dream Theater. Oh boy. Despite some of their... Yeah, okay. I can see that. Despite some of their earlier metal bands wandering into markedly sophisticated territory, Dream Theater were the first to overtly meld their love of Metallica and Iron Maiden with the DNA of Rush, Yes, Genesis, and Emerson Lake. Thus, they originated modern progressive metal and delivered many of its most remarkable and influential records, namely 1999's Metropolis Part 2, Scenes from a Memory. Yep, I agree. I'll buy it. Opeth. There we go. I called the Opeth. From the beginning, mastermind Mikhail Åkerfeldt ensured Opeth's dominion by weaving folk, jazz, and classical details into Opeth's black and death metal bedrocks. Oh, and it's so beautiful. If you've never listened to Opeth, you absolutely should. They perfected that chemistry throughout the 2000s and then doubled down on their vintage prog rock and jazz fusions inclinations over the last decade, all the while remaining wholly dignified and unmatched. Queensryche, that's a little too 80s, I think, but let's see what they say. Simply put, there'd almost certainly be no Dream Theater or the style that they engineered without Queensryche's 1988 narrative opus Operation Mindcrime. Okay, I'm listening. That said, even its two predecessors demonstrated some progressive tendencies, just as its many follow-ups perpetrated Queensryche's knack for challenging musicianship and exploratory concepts. I only know Queensryche as a better version of hair metal. Like, borderline threat. I guess, all right. I don't disagree with that one nearly as much as I did the Black Dahlia Murder, but okay. And there's Between the Buried and Me, of course. Touches of King, Crimson, Pink Floyd, and Faith No More permeated their metalcore beginnings, only to be palpably embraced on 2005's Alaska, which is a seminal record. Is so good. Over the next 15 years, they become the undisputed kings of avant-garde technical death, with their special blend of soaring melodies, imaginative storytelling, and ingeniously playful yet virtuosic eccentricities. Yep, I buy it. Sure. All right, new metal. I should excel at this one because this is what got me deep into the genre, is this subgenre. So Deftones, Korn, Limp Bizkit, and who else are they going to put on the fourth for new metal? Linkin Park, maybe? Korn, sure. With their use of seven-string guitars, hip-hop grooves, and dives into personal but relatable issues, their 93 demo, Niedermeyer's Mind, and 94 introductory LP, Korn, instigated the new metal movement. It's no wonder, then, why the virtually every band that came after Korn, from Limp Bizkit and Mudvayne is not new metal, to Suicide Silence and Poppy. Also, neither of those are new metal, so okay, I get the point. Are indebted to them, sure. Okay. I got you. Linkin Park. Yep, there it is. Oh. Let's read Linkin Park before we get ahead of ourselves. Juxtaposition of Chester Bennington's soulful singing and screaming with Mike Shinoda's rhymes were unbeatable. I don't know about that, but okay. I mean, Shinoda's rhymes, sure. Bennington's soulful singing? I guess on some of their later records. Okay. Okay, I got you. And their music was habitually nuanced, go-getting, and multifaceted, since it also incorporated slices of electronica and pop. Their last record, arguably, was only pop. Obviously, their debut duo, 2000's Hybrid Theory and 2003's Meteora, were massively prosperous game changers. 2010's staggering, ambitious A Thousand Suns is an overlooked masterpiece. I don't know about that. It was good, but overlooked masterpiece? I don't think so. System of a Down. Who did they knock off of this list? Because Deftones should be... I bet it was Deftones, because there's no way they're not going to put Limp Bizkit on the top four of nu metal. Aside from being one of the most successful nu metal bands of all time, 2001's Toxicity peaked at number one on the Billboard 200, for example. The Armenian-American quartet infused their take on the genre with plenty of political, social commentary, and culturally specific timbres. In other words, they brought newfound sundriness and artistry to the field. And then Limp Bizkit. Yep, of course. Emerging as the genre was getting started, Limp Bizkit's Fred Durst became the face of nu metal's hip-hop aesthetics and alluringly rebellious and risque subject matter. Whereas the other acts tackled deep topics in serious ways, Limp Bizkit leaned toward carefree, if contentiously testosterone-filled vibes. And we loved them for it. I don't know why that's past tense. We still love them for it. Goth metal. All right, this is going to be interesting. What would be goth metal? Let's say Typo Negative is kind of a given, because I think that's about as goth as it gets. I don't know who Loudwire would consider goth, so let's just see who this is. This is how they define goth metal. The amalgamation of goth rock and doom metal and heavy metal arose in the UK in the early 90s. Gloomily ethereal, romantic, and novelistic, goth metal is among the most vocally varied forms of metal, due in no small part to its wealth of female-fronted groups and spectrum of guttural and rhapsodic voices. So female-fronted groups, are they going to put Lacuna Coil in here? I don't know that they would be considered goth. Very likely, oh man, who is the band that Floor Jansen sings for? Nevermore. Yeah, I think that's the name of her band. So there's Typo Negative, Peter Steele, oh boy, iconic frontman Peter Steele encapsulated vampiric sexual magnetism and his pipes of steel, pardon the pun. Okay. Made him one of the subgenre's most timeless and innate vocalists. Absolutely. Typo Negative is wonderful. Likewise, Typo Negative's myriad motivators, from the Beatles, Soundgarden, and Led Zeppelin to Dead Can Dance, Joy Division, and Flock Seagulls, gave their music a routinely quirky spin. Him. Okay. Merging pop music vulnerability with rock star swagger and metal dangerousness. I don't know that I would ever call him dangerous, but okay. Finnish mastermind Vile Valo and company's presentation, sound, and iconography, i.e. the heartogram, earned him both dedicated followers and disdainful onlookers. Either way, their worldwide fame and individualized persona made them a boldly characteristic and inarguably illustrious force. What? No. Cradle of Filth is not goth metal. Black metal, yes. Goth metal, no. They stood out largely because of their black metal origins, symphonic metal leanings, and gothic fiction inspiration. Yes, that's about as goth as they get, as the inspiration for the character of Danny Filth. Naturally, their eventual branching out into other types of pop culture, film, video games, and TV appearances led some fans to label them as sellouts, but really they merely capitalized on their growing popularity without sacrificing their integrity. I would never say that Cradle of Filth sold out. Lacuna Coil. There we go. I feel like this should be... Though they might put that in symphonic metal, Nevermore. But him should not be on here. I think an upcoming band that should very likely be on here, assuming they do well for the next couple of years, is Unto Others. Those guys are fantastic and very much, very similarly minded as Typo Negative, but much more on the metal side of things, which is really fun to listen to, but somehow still also, pardon me, somehow still also more on the synthy, like 80s goth kind of side too. So yeah, very interesting band, those guys. Anyway, Lacuna Coil rounds out the top four for goth metal. Singer Christina Scavia and Andrea Farrow continuously create a riveting and venerable dichotomy. Oof, this is definitely a $10 vocabulary, tell you what. And at the time of release, 2002's Kamalis and 2006's Karma Code turned them into the best-selling rock act in Italy and the top artist in Century Media Records. Oh, wow, I didn't know that. And if they haven't secured that winning formula of beautiful aggression over the subsequent years and into 2019's Black Anima, Lacuna Coil would still be legendary. Grindcore. Who's going to qualify for grindcore? My brain's not pulling any grind acts up right now. What do you get when you combine British punk, American hardcore, and death metal? Grindcore, which serviced in England in the mid-80s and is among the noisiest, fastest, and rawest kinds of metals due to its blast beats, quick tempos, and riffing. Ear-piercing singing, both growling and screeching, overdriven guitar and bass effects, inflammatory ideas, and decidedly brief track durations. Napalm Death. All right, yeah, that makes sense. The other progenitors of the subgenre, and as we concluded back in 2016, they're still the best at it. 87's Scum established speed, subject matter, and incredibly short song lengths of grindcore, especially with You Suffer. They've stayed dedicated to their caustic attitude ever since, so much so that nearly every online grindcore ranking puts them at the top spot. Who is this? Pig Destroyer. Oh, yeah, totally wasn't even thinking about those dudes. Pig Destroyer stand out most because of their thrash and sludge metal influences, as well as the fact that they were bassless until John Jarvis joined around 2013. Therefore, they managed to equal, if not outdo, the fast ferocity of their peers with notably limited instrumentation, and frontman J.R. Hayes repeatedly exemplifies how thought-provoking yet visceral grindcore lyrics can be. Just look at all of the alliteration and rhyming in 2018's Head Case. Rotten Sound. This is the first band on this list that I do not know. true to their moniker, Runsound is likely the most relentlessly gnarly group in the Finnish scene. So they're from Finland, which is saying something. May not be as big as the other grindcore acts, but records such as 2002's Murderworks, 2005's Exit in particular, legitimize their legacy. Nasum. I know of Nasum. I have honestly never listened to this band, though I have heard of them. Despite being active for only about 10 years, even less if you're just counting their studio LPs, Scandinavian quartet Nasum's influence of politically motivated messages, catchy material, and inventive transitions will always prevail. That said, one can't help but wonder how many more awesome records they would have put out if not for guitarist, vocalist Mizeko Talarski's unfortunate demise from the infamous December 2004 Indian Ocean earthquake and tsunami disaster. Oh, that's crazy. Doom. I think Sabbath is going to find their way into this one. Who else is really doomy? I'm still drawing blanks. My brain is not reaching very well. Developed in the early 70s, doom metal focuses on bleak words, slow tempos, low-tuned guitars, distorted timbres, thick ambience, minor tonality, and cleanly operatic or dejected singing. Of course, some acts employ rougher vocals. It's not uncommon for the songwriting and or scales to be stimulated by the blues. Candlemass. All right, yep. For sure. Look at the title of their first full-length collection, 1986's Epicus Dumicus Melodicus Metallicus, for proof of how prophetic and motivational they were in to epic doom metal in particular. Consequent Messiah Marcolin period was where their heroic and mythological template shone brightest, and despite some internal hiccups over the years, they're still kicking ass today. My Dying Bride. Oh, I didn't know these guys were doom. This is another band I've heard of but never actually listened to. Sorry. Death and Gothic proclivities made them stand out right away, with their mid-90s output truly epitomizing their stellar amalgamation, whereas many of their doom metal cohorts either fell out of favor or deviated drastically from their initial identity. We're looking at you, Anathema. My Dying Bride's newest work showcases why they remain stylistic champions. Paradise Lost. This one I honestly can't say I've heard of. So that's two bands so far. They directly influenced My Dying Bride, among dozens of other doomy descendants, and they've sustained a similarly resolute but adaptable musical trajectory. 91's Gothic is often seen as a quintessential doom metal LP, and their relatively concise and direct tunes, as well as the compelling pipes of Nick Holmes, customarily result in accessible but authentic statements. Seems like a lot of word salad. Electric Wizard. All right, good. I know these guys. I like these guys. These guys have put out a couple of great records. Highly praised record, praised third record, 2000's Dope Throne, which is a great record. Displays Electric Wizard embody the stoner and sludge subsections of doom metal. Okay, so they're not going to have sludge metal in its own top four, I guess. So expect some cannabis endorsements, psychedelic tapestries, and references to horror movies and books. They've been fairly inactive over the past few years, but it's impossible to deny how much they accomplished at the height of their game. So get your bong and blacklight posters ready. They put out something not that long ago. It was a homage album to Lemmy. I can't remember the name of the record right now, but yeah, they haven't been inactive, whatever. Deathcore is basically a union of death metal and metalcore. Rose prominence in 2000s faced criticism from heavy metal fans for its implementation of punk breakdowns. There are also pig squeals, blast beats, downtuned guitars, tremolo picking galore. Younger artists have ventured into the planes of progressive metal and nu metal. So I'm kind of cheating because I can see that Whitechapel, the logo in the image for the first one. So Whitechapel, we're going to be looking at Suicide Silence, Skeleton Witch, perhaps, maybe Job for a Cowboy, but I think they've fallen out of vogue for too long. Those are my guesses. All right. So Whitechapel. Again, I kind of cheated on that one. Although they weren't quite there at the start, they began in 2006, Whitechapel's sundry influences steer them toward the beginning, deathcore's most conceptually ruthless and structurally daring torchbearers. Phil Bozeman excels at juxtaposing demonic and unaffected singing, and their evolution over the past 15 years is damn near unrivaled. Suicide Silence, called that one. They openly reject the pejorative connotation of deathcore, embracing their status as leaders of the movement. Hell, they've had two of the most viciously expressive frontmen in the field. Oh, they're also probably going to put... Lorna Shore is going to be in this, I bet. Mitch Lucker and then Hernan Eddie Hermida, resulting in a pair of distinctive yet equally riotous and demanding chapters of their career. That is, if you pretend that 2017's self-titled offering never happened. Thy Art is Murder. All right, that makes probably more sense than Lorna Shore, but we still have one more band here, so... by reaching number 35 in the ARIA charts in 2012's Hate, Quintet successfully marketed Australian deathcore to larger audiences. Beside that, their penchant for anti-religion and governmental commentary, coupled with their entrancing djent grooves, has allowed them to lead the charge down under for over a decade. Oof, I don't know if that was a good thing to put in there. Djent grooves. Job for a Cowboy. Ooh, they did put them in here. Good. Like, as much as I like Lorna Shore, I don't think that they should be considered the top of the genre. Outside of having perhaps the greatest name in the subgenre, Job for a Cowboy's 2005 Doom EP played an integral part of the rise of deathcore. True, they've veered closer to traditional / progressive death metal since then, but that just shows how impactful Doom was to the legions of bands who let it bring them into the fold. Oh boy, gent. Term is an onomatopoeia for the captivatingly chunky, elastic and intricate Swedish style of metal that began around 95, defines its palm-muted, high-gain guitar work and mesmerizing polymetered syncopation. So, of course, Meshuggah. Other acts that they're likely going to put in here, even though Meshuggah probably would hate the fact that they are on this list. Animals as Leaders... who else is going to be on here? Oh, I have it on the tip of my brain, but I can't think of the band's name. Anyway, we're going to continue on. Meshuggah with 95's Destroy, Erase, Improve. Lead guitarist Frederick Thorndahl originated the technique, making Meshuggah the godfathers of djent. While many fans agree their best work is behind them, their latest sequence, 2016's Violent Sleep of Reason, was nonetheless lauded for its towering quality and live recording charisma. Yeah, it's a great record. Not their best, but a great record. Periphery, that's who I was trying to think of. Self-effacing fivesome dish out charmingly silly songwriting, infectious melodies, and adventurous instrumentation like no one else. In addition, their triumphant rise to becoming one of modern metal's most renowned ensembles is justly credited for dragging djent from the virtual world into the real one. Yeah, I'm just not a fan. I don't think Periphery's that good. Why would they be on top of this subgenre? Animals as Leaders, called that one because, yeah, they're just great. Instrumental djent doesn't get better than this Washington, D.C. trio. Each member is mind-blowingly skilled and resourceful, coding their compositions with enough jazz, fusion, digital effects, and all-encompassing zany detours to give you goosebumps. And then Tesseract. That's, yeah, okay. I think I like these guys a little bit better than Periphery, but still not a big fan. Incomparably poignant, intrepid, and robust, joining the typical hecticness of the form with heavenly atmospheres and deeply moving confessions. The way in which vocalist Daniel Tompkins pours his heart out over the gorgeously malleable arrangements is downright awe-inspiring. They've only grown more capable as they've gotten more popular. Are they popular, though? Is djent still a popular subgenre of the scene? I don't think so. I think it's more of a punchline these days, but I could be wrong. All right, modern metalcore. No clear time frame or definition for this one, but suffice it to say that it is more or less blossomed around the mid-2000s and contentiously incorporated more musical and visual elements of screamo, emo, electronica, mainstream rock, pop punk into its metal and hardcore punk roots. It was the time of scene kids in MySpace, and while certain bands didn't lean too far that direction, many did. So who is going to be top of modern metalcore? We're going to say Killswitch Engage. They might put August Burns Red here, and hopefully Shadows Fall. I don't know who else is going to be here. Unearth, maybe? Oof. Bring Me the Horizon? Ugh, what is that? They're among the most... I mean, I know who Bring Me the Horizon is, but why would they be one of the big four of the subgenre? I don't know. They're among the most controversially... chameleonically artists. What? Are you just making up words now, Loudwire? As they stealthily transitions from their deathcore basis, 2006's Counter Blessings, to more conventional metalcore, 2008's Suicide Season, and then into a hodgepodge of alternative punk, electropop, nu metal, and arena rock on their later releases. That trajectory, Finn McKinty loves these guys. Punk Rock MBA thinks that they're the greatest because they are so different from record to record, which is artistically respectable, but I just am not a fan of the music they put out. That trajectory matched with the divisively characteristic personality frontman Oliver Sykes makes them emissaries of the era. Who is this? Architects. Oh, I totally forgot about Architects. DNA of 2000 metalcore, namely Dillinger Escape Plan, can be felt in their first few LPs, whereas subsequent ones saw them expanding into more melodic, symphonic, progressive, and ambient tapestries. Their last two efforts, 2018's Holy Hell and 2021's For Those That Wish to Exist, were significantly praised for showcasing their ability to keep evolving and satisfying in the wake of losing founding multi-instrumentalist Tom Searle. Under Oath. Why? Oh, that must be... It must be... This word that's throwing me off, modern metalcore, because all of those bands are kids compared to who I thought was going to be on this list. Under Oath, over their 20 plus year career, they've proven to be immensely diverse, ranging from early dives into death metal and black metal to newer glimpses of screamo, melodic hardcore, post-rock, Christian metal, and even indie rock. 2005's Define the Great Line is almost undeniably their peak in several ways, but each record offers something worthwhile. Arguable. Parkway Drive. Yeah, these are all bands that have come out since Killswitch Engage and such, so... It's the modern thing that threw me off. They're easily among Australia's top-tier metalcore groups in terms of both sales and sound. They set themselves apart by their peers by sticking to their bedrocks of unclean singing and breakdowns until 2015's Ire. It's not necessarily a complaint, though, as they've done a fine job of venturing towards classic heavy metal with their latest material. Industrial. Let's read their definition. I think I know where they're going with this, but let's read their definition first. Both sides are fairly international, with the rock variant arising in the late 70s and the metal variant coming about mid 80s. In either case, you're essentially adding industrial elements, synths, sequencers, sampling, distorted vocals, avant-garde electronics, looping, and transgressive / subversive songwriting and visuals to the foundational qualities. So... Again, I just cheated, but Nine Inch Nails for sure. Rammstein and Ministry. Skinny Puppy, perhaps, but I don't think they're mainstream enough to be considered top four, but I don't know who else Loudwire would be listing. So let's see. Nine Inch Nails. Like I said, I kind of cheated. Today, Mastermind Trent Reznor is winning awards for his soundtrack work alongside Nine Inch Nails newcomer Atticus Ross. But back in the 90s and 2000s, he encapsulated the anthemic, boundary-pushing sights and sounds of the art form. His first three LPs are easily the most revered, yet 2020's Two Ghosts sequences saw him perpetuating the same sort of darkness and anxiety beneath ambient textures and nightmarish pulses. Yeah, Ghosts is great. I've listened to it minimally, but it is a lot of fun. I don't think Nine Inch Nails have put out a bad record. So anything that has Trent's name on it is going to be worth a listen. Rammstein, of course, led by the incomparable Till Lindemann. Those gothically theatrical German humorists are industrial metal's shining beacon of highly salacious yet immensely endearing and prosperous satire and sexuality. Virtually every aspect of their artistry influences prudish outsiders, infuriates prudish outsiders, while enamoring devotees with an unshakable and unshakably defiant commitment to their playful antics, creative scores, and deceptively camouflaged sagacity. Yeah, Rammstein's great. Of course, Ministry, Al Jorgensen with his 75 facial piercings. To be fair, visionary Al Jorgensen was innovating at the same time as Reznor, but his speedy evolution from synth-pop EBM danceability to palpable heavy metal dissonance and industrial sampling reasonably shows greater growth in a shorter amount of time. Honestly, Ministry might not be as much of a household name, but they almost surely stuff more styles into their idiosyncratic collage. All right, so, interesting choice. Fear Factory, definitely industrial metal. Dino Casadas with his godlike right hand. Kings of infusing industrial attributes with groove, death, and nu metal underpinnings, greatly motivating artists such as Devin Townsend, Machine Head, Slipknot, As a Late Dying. Yep, with staples such as Demanufacture and Obsolete ever since their hooky melodies, sci-fi storytelling, and orchestral flourishes have sustained their supremacy. Fear Factory is fabulous. Black metal. All right. Who's going to be black metal? Behemoth, Amon Amarth. Probably. Oh, what is that? Silly band. Zeal and Ardor. I don't know who the fourth one's going to be, but I bet it's them. I bet it's those bands. Mayhem. Duh. Think of Norwegian black metal without thinking of Mayhem, as they immediately set the stage with their first EP, Death Crush, and genre-defying LP, De Mysteris Dom Satanas. Of course, 2019's Daemon shows that they're still going strong. An abundance of controversies influenced the chronicled Lords of Chaos book and film enhance their one-of-a-kind clout. Yeah, totally wasn't thinking about them. Emperor. That's Isan right there. Characteristic presence of founding member guitarist vocalist Isan alone is enough to justify Emperor's reign, and their striving and epic symphonic elements definitely distinguish them further. Hell, we named their classically tinged sophomore sequence Anthems to the Welkin at Dusk the greatest black metal of all time. True that. Dark Throne. Wow, I didn't call any of these, though I agree with all of them, not gonna lie. Transition from death to black with the treasured unholy trinity of 92's Ablaze in the Northern Sky, 93's Under a Funeral Moon, and 94's Transylvanian Hunger. Also, their influence of punk and hard rock attributes make them one of the leading forces in Blackened Crust and Black and Roll. Interesting. I like that. Validating why they're atypically diverse and fearless. And then Enslaved. Again, didn't call any of those bands. Increasingly welcome, recognizable, because I just took Loudwire to be different. I thought they were going to be more mainstream with their selections, but they were not. Increasingly welcoming and recognizable mixture of black metal, progressive metal, folk metal, jazz metal, and Viking metal is second to none. It began as solid yet traditional acts and have been widening and refining their creativity ever since, making them a truly singular quintet. All right, so we have one, two, three, four, five. What is going on? Goodness. I don't know what's going on. There we go. We have five more to go through, so we'll hold those off until the next one. So that means I have to keep this tab open. All right. That is where we're going to call this first half of the stream, even though it's significantly longer than I anticipated. We've been going for an hour and a half. So thank you very much, nerds. If you are listening in post and you're only doing the news portion, then you just came to the end. Thank you for sticking it out with me. A little bit longer than anticipated. I guess I should have done a little bit more homework going forward. But yeah, we are going to be taking a break and then coming back and playing some stuff with the games and the things and the things and the stuff. Gonna try out some multiverses. I have only just downloaded it, so I have yet to play. And then a couple rounds of Halo and we'll call it a night. Thank you very much. Again, for those of you in post who are just catching the news, thank you for joining me. We'll see you in the next one. Before we do go, always, always remember that if it's generally nerdy, it's probably here. For the rest of you, we'll see you in about 10-ish minutes.